Hello there, this is Mark Bauerlein again for another conversation. Today we have Richard Spady in our offices. He's known to First Things readers for his many pieces, reviews, and commentaries, essays that he's done for us. He is research professor at Johns Hopkins and senior research fellow at Nuffield College in Oxford. His last book, I believe, 2014, was co-authored, and it's entitled The American Political Landscape. Richard, thank you for joining us.
I'm happy to be here.
Richard, you have an essay in the April issue entitled Economics as Ideology. What do you mean by economics as ideology?
Well, I think of it in three ways. The first two have to do with the assumptions that economics makes. It makes a deep assumption in autonomous, utility-maximizing individuals. It sees people always in this way as being endowed with arbitrary tastes that they're going to try to maximize their utility by satisfying their tastes. Another is that whenever you expand the possibilities for doing something that you couldn't do before, such as technological change, such as mobility of labor and capital, such as free trade, all these possibilities will be realized in a way so that the losers indeed are compensated, that things will work out in the way envisioned by the theory. And the third thing is that it sets in motion social processes that attempts to make these assumptions actually true. They're not true, but the way in which economics operates in society tends to make these things more true than they otherwise would have been.
So in a case like free trade, the economists will approach the phenomena that follow from open borders of some kind will be motivated to sort of assume the free trade is happening, that it is opening these things up, and that certain anticipations will have been realized, and the economist then shows their realization at work. Is that?
That's certainly part of it. The other part is that the calculation that economists do is that the opportunities opened up by free trade are so big that there are enough gains to go around for everybody and that they will be shared out. But in fact, they're not shared out. So the assumption is that this sharing or redistribution or that the gains will be so great that they swamp the losses and disruption that the trade causes. So that's an important piece of it. The other piece that I would draw attention to is people are not autonomous, utility maximizing individuals. But the way in which people are taught and conditioned in the economy, the effect of our economic programs, is to produce that in people, to make them conceive of themselves that way, and then to act in that way.
Hmm. And then those who act well in that way, they succeed, and so they reinforce the definition.
Absolutely.
So the people who don't act as autonomous utility maximizers, the people who do things that seem to minimize their utility, how do the economists understand those people? They're uneducated.
Right. They're the, you know, I was reading an article which referred to the fact that, studies have been done that the people have stayed behind in areas that have suffered economic dislocations. You know, things didn't turn out very well for them. And, you know, the subtext of that is it didn't turn out very well for them, and it's their fault, as
right.
it were. That, and indeed, people learn that if you are going to fit in with the new things, you better move. And there's a question about whether, you know, to some degree, that's desirable, but perhaps not to the degree that would be required today.
Do the economists, most of whom are academics, they move around a lot, they fly abroad, they do consultations with different wealthy organizations, do they simply have no feel, no awareness of the actual life world of a lot of the people that they're talking about? I mean, the old elite bubble problem. You see that afflicting economists?
Oh, absolutely. I think that the academic system undermines institutional loyalties, and people sort of valorize the lack of their institutional loyalties, and you know, see, well, think that other people ought to feel the same way. So you see this, I think, particularly in academic administrators who now, you know, go from institution to institution, and they're 3 years here, they're 4 years there, they're 5 years there. And when you're substitutable like that, you no longer have any loyalty or sense of the institution as an individual, you know, entity, nor loyalty to it.
You know, even I remember 20 years ago hearing people in the humanities who were starting to talk about the institution and how it affected humanities work, that people in the in an English department who are in 18th century studies, they will feel more camaraderie with another 18th century studies person at a university 1,000 miles away than with the medievalist down the hall.
Oh, absolutely. And not only that, I mean, that's not so bad. It's that it's laudable to feel that way. I'm more loyal to econometrics. I'm an econometrician, right? Many people will say, well, you know, I'm more loyal to econometrics than I am to my university or to the project of teaching students, actually. I'm loyal to the abstract discipline of econometrics, and that allows me to go anywhere.
And so they tend by their own conditions not to understand workers who want a home, who
That's
want
right.
the workplace to be a relationship of loyalty, and that, you know, the company's taking, I'm working hard for the company's taking care of me. I remember my mother was a real estate person who sold in a subdivision in Montgomery County, Maryland for a few years there. And she had, you know, job data on everyone in the neighborhood. This is a Maryland suburb now. And many of the people who came in were IBM. Mm-hmm. And back then, IBM would move people around a lot. The joke was IBM stood for I've been moved.
Right.
So they'd move every 3 or 4 years. IBM would buy their house.
Right.
IBM would take care of all. So you had the mobility, but you had the loyalty as well. You're with IBM for life. And most of these people were lifers with that one company. I mean, you know, why, who would want to leave IBM now?
Well, now, I'm not sure. IBM has gone through its ups and downs, right?
Were they? Yeah.
I worked for Bell Laboratories for a while in the 80s. And in 1984, there's an antitrust decree that breaks up AT&T, which is a very different company than the one that you know now. And people had not conceived that their employment wasn't for life. But it wasn't. And so
the
I think
economists
that people have now with respect to that operates too, not to make people more skeptical about the corporation, although that is part of the effect, but mostly more anxious about being sure that they're not the ones eliminated.
Right. Well, that's one of the terms. You hear these terms, creative disruption.
Right.
Destructive, you know, innovation. For a lot of the economists, they say this frees up capital, this creates greater mobility. But disruption, destruction, those aren't good words for most people. I mean, you start being anxious about your actual living condition. Do the economists appreciate that? Those feelings of uncertainty, of uprootedness?
I think that economists have, you know, a part of the economics establishment is certainly aware of problems in income distribution. But I don't think that they're very aware of the social transformation that's occurred by the incentive effects that the sort of ruthless meritocracy that we now have has generated.
I think about college admissions, for instance, in terms of ruthless meritocracy. I feel very bad for kids going to college these days.
Absolutely.
All the choices are so fraught.
Well, this is probably more negative than one needs to be. You know, when you run into people who, the other day, an electrician came to my house to fix the generator, and he really doesn't know how he should think about college for his kids. And he has two kids, and they're going to college, and one's going to start at Penn State, the other one's already there. And, you know, I also see parents with their kids walking around at Johns Hopkins doing the tour, which I did, I don't know, 10 years ago with my daughter.
Mm-hmm. And my son, my nephew went to Johns Hopkins.
And, you know, one of the things, I'm sure my fellow economists would be horrified to hear me say this, or even the faculty, but I don't think anybody in the university cares at all about your kid. And when I say that, I mean, they don't care about your kid as an individual. They care about your kid as a customer, possibly, right? And as long as that customer isn't creating more trouble than the associated, well, mostly revenue stream, but utility stream for the university, you know, the university's happy.
If you're not ending up in academic counseling, if you're not ending up in psychological center, if you're not getting too drunk and ending up in the emergency room, you know, and you're getting B's, we're happy.
Right.
That's going. You know, in terms of the meritocracy point, let me read a couple paragraphs from your essay, and let you comment on them. You've given some of a pessimistic outlook on the profession of economics and our future. Many of my friends who are economists discount my pessimism. Talent has a wonderful future, they remind me. Very true, I reply. And that's our problem in another guise. And here, that's your statement. Now you comment. Not everyone has talent, although we like to pretend that everyone has a talent. Economic theory helps us pretend. In international trade theory, for example, even the poorest nation has a comparative advantage. Even the least fortunate person has a comparative advantage based on some skill or talent of which he has relatively more, though the absolute amount of the talent may be small. If we could get rid of the minimum wage, the purists argue, then everyone would have a role in the labor market, even the least talented, though admittedly they wouldn't get paid very much. Most economists don't focus on people with very low levels of talent. That's the key point I saw here. And thus, they don't have to explain the exchange value of low IQ combined with poor work habits and bad manners.
The demands for talent are themselves, you know, what I call in the article, endogenous. They're determined by the economic system. They, you know, one way in which given tastes and given conditions, the assumption of such things, makes people, distorts thought, is that it says, well, you know, these people, they don't fit very well into the economy. There's nothing I can do about that, right? It's not like there was a decision made to eliminate low wage labor, they think, or to lower the rewards. Or that there was a decision made not to care very much about how the schools operate, because that doesn't actually affect anybody in a world in which the lower levels of talent are in less demand, and you can always, if necessary, import people to substitute for the labor profiles that are in short supply. So I think that I think that these aspects are not taken very seriously by the contemporary policy elite, which is largely influenced by economists.
I think that when Donald Trump said, I'm trying to remember, was this in Nevada, maybe West Virginia, Nevada, I can't remember, where he said, after he'd won, I love low-educated people. I mean, when I mentioned this to my liberal friends and colleagues, they just found this so absolutely off the chart bizarre and appalling. Mm-hmm. That he would, you're praising people for being stupid. That's what you're doing, Trump. And I said back to them, you know, these people never hear anyone in the elite say anything good about them. I think this is probably one of the first times a politician has said something that they actually believed he really means it. And it's true. Now, I might have tried to use
a euphemism, like ordinary people or
everyday Joe, or something like that. Yeah, I think actually highlighting low, I think he said low educated.
No, he actually used those words. That's right.
I think that we have heard part of the neoliberal world for 30 years has been education. This is your way up. This is what everyone has to do. Everyone has to go to college. The George W. Bush's administration pushed this just as much as liberal administrations did. Everyone has to get college, and if you're not, you're left behind. You're really not part of the system. We don't even need to account for you, except as sort of this dross population.
Yeah, and there is this view that you can educate everyone to be above average.
Right.
Of course, you can't do that.
No.
And if we just move various types of formal education qualifications up, that's really not going to address the problem of solidarity in society.
Right. I mean, look, the numbers are. I mean, more people are getting more education than ever before. They're going higher on the education ladder. But you do not see any gains in test results, for instance.
Right.
For example, on the collegiate learning assessment, which is
end
of college,
isn't it?
you just don't see the gains taking place. But you see more credentials.
More credentials. That enters into the equations of the econometricians.
Well, Richard, about this initial assumption, as you put it, of human beings are utility maximizing creatures. Where did that come? Does that go way back? Is it the rational choice people from the 60s? Who did economists always talk about human beings? All the way back to Adam Smith in this way.
You know, I can't put my finger on an actual economist who makes a big break from a tradition.
Uh-huh.
And says, this is the way you ought to think about people.
Yeah.
I mean, the formalizations of utility theory, in the 40s and 50s, the early mathematization of the subject,
mm-hmm.
made it necessary to be explicit about what you were going to assume about people. And, for example, general equilibrium theory, as something called pure exchange economies, in which people are endowed not only with their tastes, but they're sort of a bundle of goods, which doesn't include actually their talents or any sort of human dimension. They just have some goods, and you have some goods, and we're going to have a price mechanism that makes exchange happen so that everybody's utility is maximized. But the mathematical exercise of doing that, I think, accustoms people to thinking in certain ways, mm-hmm. along certain tracks.
Mm-hmm. Who are the figures who have influenced you in not in your general economic thinking, but also on the line of a little bit of dissident understanding of economics that you have?
Well, it's funny. I was a philosophy undergraduate as well as an economics undergraduate.
Where were you an undergrad?
At Haverford College.
That's where our editor-in-chief went, Haverford. You guys must be very close. Secret handshakes,
all that stuff. Yeah, and then I went to MIT, which is very standard economics education.
Isn't it extraordinary? Maybe you may have been the one who argued this or passed this to Rusty. It's an extraordinary number of economics economists who've gone into political policy came out of MIT.
Sure, Ben Bernanke, who was chairman of the Fed, the current chairman of the European, I guess it's called the Central Bank, Mario Draghi. They were within a couple years of me,
mm-hmm.
One way or the other, at MIT.
But your philosophy.
Taught by the vice chairman of the Fed, Stanley Fisher.
Huh.
I guess he's now just resigned during the last little bit.
Did your philosophical studies at Haverford, any of those seem to have a lingering impact?
Actually, you know, I was thinking about this, you know, looking at my piece and thinking, you know, where did this come from? And really, you know, Haverford's a rather left-wing sort of place, and we read Frankfurt School guys, as well as classical. I have to say, I got a good classical philosophy education.
Mm-hmm.
And among the people who most influenced me, I think, were Habermas and Herbert Marcuse, both of whom, you know, Habermas is a left-wing leading European social thinker. Marcuse is a Marxist theorist. And indeed, I think I sort of cribbed economics as ideology from a Habermas essay called Technology and Science as Ideology.
Huh.
And there he sort of decries the fact that technology and science and the society as we have it then works in an ideological fashion. And of course he means this as a critique from the left. And Marcuse says, well, you know, the mainstream society is very much in favor of tolerance, but tolerance isn't really freedom. Repressive tolerance operates to suppress the true interests of people and their freedom. And, you know, it's quite a left-wing critique.
It was a powerful, very influential thesis.
And, you know, what turned it around for me, I think, I mean, there are many things that did change my views, is Christopher Lash, who, you know, in his early days is viewed as a Marxist social historian.
Right.
But goes on to make a sort of populist critique of American society that has all the elements we've already been discussing. And, you know, he writes Haven in a Heartless World about the decline of the family, he writes Culture of Narcissism about how cultural products, you know, affect our personality.
I love the subtitle of The Culture of Narcissism. Is it American Life in an Age of Diminishing Expectations? I think that was the full subtitle of that
and
book.
And, you know, what happened in those times, you know, the diminishing expectations, there was a period where that was very much a theme, and then things got better in the 90s. But I think the underlying anxiety of people mm-hmm. never really went away.
Hmm.
So that's, you know, sort of ties back to the notion of the ruthless meritocracy. But Lash really turned things around in terms of my views of how these things operated. So I tend to now think, well, repressive tolerance is what the left-wing progressive system exercises on people today.
I think so.
You know,
I think it actually applies very well.
Yeah, and so I think that, I you know, one of the things that Habermas would complain about was how ethics and the concept of the moral life had been drained from sort of the public space. And he attributed this to our accepting science and technology as being the primary ways of understanding ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
And he thought that somehow legitimation was going to follow from open and free discussion. I think that actually is a mistake. Mm-hmm. I mean, not that I'm against open and free discussion. I just don't think that that alone is a solid enough thing to base social solidarity on
mm-hmm.
and a moral and ethical understanding.
What else do we need in your eyes?
I've been influenced lately in my thinking about that by Roger Scruton and Catherine Pokolik. Scruton has a nice book called On Human Nature, in which he points out, well, you know, people are characterized by their freedom, their self-consciousness, and their responsibility. And he says, you know, it's the task of philosophy to try to show that about people, but if you're religious, you're, you know, most of the way there already. And I think that was, you know, that sort of position through other people, too, has influenced my thinking a lot. And then Catherine has a nice essay on freedom, that freedom, you know, freedom isn't getting to decide what's right and wrong. freedom isn't getting to choose the autonomous, go back to the picture of the autonomous individual. Freedom is not going down to the 7-Eleven and getting to buy anything you want, right? But that is the picture that economics brings you, right? And that, you know, the natural extension of that notion of freedom is not only get to pick what you want to buy, but you get to pick what's, as it were, right and wrong. That your decision about what's right and wrong is the most important part of freedom. And I think that does go back to a tradition like of John Stuart Mill and people like that. And what Catherine's essay points out is something like, well, no, and you also see this in some of the papal encyclicals, freedom is, in a sense, understanding that you are subject to natural and moral laws. The notion of obedience in the case of, well, you have to, you know, the earth goes around the sun, well, that obeys a law, right? We have to understand our nature as human beings and that these things stand outside of us, right? That the you can't just by an act of will project what is right and wrong or project what is indeed there, mm-hmm. which of course I think economics actually does try to do. It tries to project the notion of the autonomous individual.
Final question. How many economists do have a religious sense of some kind? I know that's a broad question. This is just...
Well, it's not something people talk about, but you can tell by the lunchtime conversation how many are quite hostile.
There is some hostility.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes, I think there is. You know, it's been made worse by recent political events.
Yeah.
But I think that that's been there now for a long time. One of the things I've seen, you know, as a problem in economic modeling is if you look at things like family formation, divorce, children and their outcomes, you're never allowed to discuss the effect of family structure on these things, except possibly as a so-called dummy variable.
It's just not part of the picture.
What would be the policy implications of that?
That's what we're getting, yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Right, so economics is driven in many ways by the notion that what we're gonna do is make a policy intervention.
Right.
And we need some answers and we need them sort of now.
Yeah.
Now we've seen it sort of needed
we
now.
We need actionable intelligence.
Exactly, and we've needed this for 30 years. The idea that 30 years ago you could have said, you know, actually what you really need to do is understand things. Then we worry about acting on them later. Because, you know, you got 30 years, it could be the same place 30 years from now.
Yeah.
That's not there at all. So there's this constant push, since you can incentivize people because
right.
they are utility maximizing individuals whose endowments are given. Because of that, you know, there's this idea that there are levers on the outside of the machine.
Give them a nudge.
Yeah, give them a nudge.
Here and there.
Right. All that nudge stuff is
yes.
really... insidious.
Yes, yes, yes. Well, I saw this in the think tanks when I was sitting in on those frequently and you know, when I was in D.C. for a few years. And really, people were looking for, okay, do we have some data, some material, some ideas that we can jump right on
mm-hmm.
and do something with them up on the Hill?
Yeah.
That's how they look at it. And you're right. What are you going to do with stuff about the family? That's a dead end.
You can't do anything about
politically,
that.
Politically, you don't touch it. So.
Right. Not always. Politically, it's a dead end. People don't have any understanding. Well, they don't really want to know an understanding of how people's attitudes and dispositions relate to their behaviors. And I think part of that is simply disciplinary. You know, that belongs to the social psychologist.
Yeah, yeah.
Another piece is, well, I don't have the data on that, so I'm going to use the data I have, and I'm just going to pretend that
yeah.
it doesn't matter whether I have the data on the other things. Things I don't have data on, they don't count.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right? Or, you know, for the time being, we should have this discussion that's isolated in these ways. Well, the time being goes on for a generation, and no one remembers that you said we're going to forget about these things.
Yeah.
We're going to, you know, hold them constant.
Well, and here we are.
And here we are.
Richard Spadey, thank you.
Thanks, Mark.